Welcome to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips, a color-conscious podcast about politics. I'm your host, Steve Phillips, and last week, the country celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday. Today, we're going to talk about the efforts to carry on some of King's most important work. Dr. King wrote about poverty, among other topics, in his last book, Where Do We Go From Here? In that book, he wrote the following. He said, "The programs of the past all have a common failing. They are indirect. Each seeks to solve poverty by first solving something else. I am now convinced that the simplest approach will prove to be the most effective. The solution to poverty is to abolish it directly by a now widely discussed measure, the guaranteed income." And on today's podcast, we're going to talk with one of the principal leaders carrying on the economic justice work that King devoted his life to, and particularly this piece around a guaranteed income. He's a returning guest and a friend of the podcast. And for this conversation, I'm joined by my co-host, Charlene Chang. Hi, Charlene. How are you? And do you want to introduce our guest?
Hey, Steve. I'm doing great. And I'm so thrilled to have our guest on today back again. One of the things we've been having is some prior guests on. And the way I think about it is because we can't help it. We pick awesome guests and they are doing awesome things all the time and gaining more insight, experience, and power. And getting to check in on them on their journeys is, I think, just this really rich way to share with our listeners. It's not a one-time deal, right? It's like the people we are lifting up and shining a light on, they just continue to be more impactful in the world. And so that's why we're having today's guest back on, because he keeps doing more and more amazing things. So our guest today is Michael Tubbs. And Michael Tubbs, at the age of 26, became the youngest mayor of any major city in American history. And he was also the first African-American mayor of Stockton, California. He's the founder of the Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, which is also referred to as MGI. That's a coalition of 30 mayors which advocates for an income floor for all Americans. He also serves as the special advisor to Governor Gavin Newsom for economic mobility. And his most recent initiative, End Poverty in California, or EPIC for short, is a nonprofit that advocates for statewide policies that will reduce the racial wealth gap. He has so many accolades. I'll just list a few. He's been a fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics, MIT Media Lab, USC Center for the Political Future, and the Stanford Design School. And if that was enough, he's the author of The Deeper the Roots, a fantastic book, a memoir. And he's the executive producer of It's Basic, which premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival last year in 2023. That film won Best Documentary at the Downtown LA Film Festival last year. And yes, this is the third time we've had Michael Tubbs on. And like I said, it's because he just keeps doing awesome stuff. So we love checking in with him. And we'll post links to the episodes we've had on with him before if you haven't caught them yet. And yes, the last time we did discuss with him his, working with EPIC and their goals to end poverty, and we're hoping to just get caught up on how that's going. If all of that was not enough, he is the father of three. Welcome, Michael. And I'm just so happy to have you here. And I wanted to say that because there was just a primary yesterday, primary election, before we really spend the most of this episode on talking about your work and related topics, I do want to do a little quick check with you and Steve on just sort of gut reaction, immediate thoughts so far to the New Hampshire primary results last night.
Well, first, it's always good to be back with family. So thank you, Steve and Charlie, for having me back. It's always good to talk with people you actually like to talk to. But I think to the point of your introduction, what was fascinating is we just had a conversation with MGI mayors, a U.S. Conference of Mayors. We are now at 150 mayors. So it's amazing sort of how much we've grown.
I got to update my,
Hearing you say that, I was like, oh my gosh, like we have really grown really, really quickly. But in terms of New Hampshire, I think I'm actually shocked that Nikki Haley came as close as she did. Because just last week, she was at 24-30%. Maybe, probably not the nicest thing to say, but I'm excited to see this Republican on Republican bloodbath and to see sort of how she continues to give us viral clips that President Biden could use in the reelection against Trump. And as Trump will seek to demolish her, so she'll never be able to run for office again. So I think for Dems, it's a win-win. I hope she stays on to the bitter end.
How about you, Steve?
Yeah. So we'll just like real quick before that. Just interesting that you're doing the intro and the. I didn't realize, Michael, that this is the third documentary you've been associated with, right? Because there were two on your own work, and then now you were producing this one, and so. I think you know, and I've told other, I don't know if we've even fully said on this podcast, but we're doing a documentary on Susan's life and legacy. And I'm actually in Austin, Texas right now as we're recording this, doing a bunch of meetings in terms of trying to see how we can support the work in Texas. And the filmmaker, Chelsea Hernandez, is from Austin. So we are actually, she was filming yesterday, me and Julie walking down the street here in Austin. And then Trey Martinez Fisher is the, I wish I have him on as a future guest, actually. He's the head of the House Caucus. He's the top Democrat in the state legislature. So we had lunch yesterday. And so then they were filming the beginning of that. And it's almost like we were like these super important people or whatnot. But we'll have to compare documentary production notes at some point. In terms of New Hampshire, I had actually hoped that Haley would do a little bit better. I mean, I think it's, there's so many different writ large realities to this. Some of the things I've tried to talk about, you know, in the book and some of the columns I've written is we have consistently and historically underestimated the political appeal and power of white rage and racial resentment. And that there was all this, you know, talked about, you know, in 2015 that Trump didn't have a chance and he was too, you know, extreme. It wasn't serious, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we talked about this before, but he was at 4% in the polls in May of 2015. And then he announces in June of 2015, attacks Mexicans as rapists and murderers. And then he sends the signal that he's going to be the defender of white people. And zoomed up in the polls immediately and has never looked back. And so what we're seeing is they keep talking about the takeover of Trump, but the essence of Trump's appeal is this white racial rage and resentment, up to and including all these racially charged attacks on Nikki Haley leading up to New Hampshire. Like, but you know, her parents aren't, you know, from the US and this and that. So we're seeing in real time the inexorable power of this sector of the population that wants to make America white again, and it is bending to its will all of the opponents, all of the different donors who have been trying to. It's been hundreds. What did I see that or hear on one of these podcasts? I think it's Ted Herndon's podcast, who we had on our podcast, was saying that in Iowa, Ron DeSantis and his super PAC spent $150 million in Iowa, and came in a very distant, you know, second in that regard. So it's not that Trump is strong. It's that Trump has figured out the power of these appeals to white nationalism and this white racial resentment. And we are seeing it being quantified in real time. So Haley is the last one standing, but she's not going to be standing for long. She's going to try to make it to South Carolina February 26th, but I'm not even sure she's going to make it that far.
Yeah, I'll just say I kind of feel I was of the mind of both of what you're feeling is, on one hand, because I just didn't fully know what to expect. On one hand, I was glad that she did as well as she, like, I'm no big fan. Let's just be clear. I'm not like, you know, Nikki Haley is like, I mean, I could just go off about her. Having said that, the fact that, like what Steve said, is that she still does represent, I mean, she is a woman, she is a woman of color, even though she's trying to walk that line, and that even within what's currently happening in the Republican Party there, you know, with you know, Trump supporters, they're just going full throttle attacking her. Of course, I feel for her, for what that represents, not necessarily feeling for her like as an individual, but just it's so clear. So I was also glad that she represents something that's in the game and that there are people who voted for her because they wanted an alternative and that there were people who were still willing to vote for a woman of color who is a child of immigrants and she's, you know, she's Asian. So there's a part of it was very kind of complex feelings for me because on one hand I was like, yes, there are people voting for her, but I also recognize, like, agree with Steve that it's the larger takeaway is unfortunately still quite demoralizing, which is that despite everything that Trump has done and he has shown himself to be, as he has said before, I'm paraphrasing something like, I could take somebody out on Fifth Avenue and people would still love me. And I am increasingly just feel like that is literally true. And that what does this guy need to do? And what does it say about my fellow Americans? And we will obviously see this November. My heart still kind of broke a bit when I really sat with that type of reality check after seeing the results. That's where I am today, you know, right now.
It's not just Fifth Avenue now. He can incite a riot in which people die.
Yes.
And they still love him. It's not even more so. Right. Or not just
where they attack cops, where they like literally attack law enforcement, where they threaten to kill the vice president.
Their own. And yet the snake eating its own tail is what I sometimes think of as like that image.
Two other things about New Hampshire actually make me think about it. So this is on you're talking about the complicated. It's fascinating to watch the Republicans both navigate and embrace and play around with race. And so Haley, you know, as a woman of color, trying to really be we talked about the thing on a prior pod, be the face of white nationalism, but as a woman of color, trying to navigate all of that. And then Haley appointed, and I talk about this in How We Win the Civil War, Tim Scott, African-American, who has like really had no qualifications. He'd only won like 6,000 votes in his small little, you know, election seat. She appointed him to the U.S. Senate in December 2012 after Obama was reelected. And they were like, black candidates are doing good. I guess we got to find somebody. And so then they elevate Tim Scott, who himself ran. And then now he is like embarrassingly up on stage with Trump yesterday. And I tweeted out, I don't know, people know his historical reference of Step and Fetch It. It was one of these 1930s caricature black people, black comedian caricature piece. So people looked at this stumbling, inarticulate, kind of head scratching. So I put the Step and Fetch It 2024 around the Tim Scott thing. And I said, maybe it'll be a Trump Fetch It ticket. So anyway, you just see this reality of how all these people are kind of like, and then Trump's tolerating it because he's trying to play a little bit of racial games as well. So that was one thing. More pertinent, and I don't think should be lost in this election in New Hampshire. Without getting into all the historical things about the why New Hampshire goes first, et cetera, Biden changed the order because he wanted it no longer to be white states leading off the election. So they started with South Carolina is going to be the first state for the Democrats. But New Hampshire is always like they've gone state first for 50 years. And they wanted to keep going first. And so they went ahead and held their primary, even though the delegates don't count. And then Biden wasn't even on the ballot. But people were giving all this credibility that this, I tweeted about this yesterday, too, incredibly narcissistic and dangerous errand of this Democratic congressman, Dean Phillips, no relation to me, is running against Biden. And no one has even ever heard of this person before, and let alone what is he even doing? And we're all trying to fight fascism, and he's out there on this lark of trying to put himself on the ballot. So he was on the ballot in New Hampshire. Biden was not. And then there's a lot of people in the media saying like, it's going to be embarrassing. It's going to show weakness for Biden, and that he's, you know, Dean Phillips is going to beat him. So they mounted a write-in campaign, and the write-in campaign, which was much harder than just voting, destroyed Phillips. So Biden won like by 50 points or something in that election yesterday, even though he wasn't even on the ballot. So I think it's important to dispel these narratives of Biden's weakness, because we are going to need to, we do have a majority, but we're going to need to have enthusiasm and high turnout. So I think that's an important piece of what happened yesterday.
All right. With that, let's get down to checking in with Michael and hearing all about what he's been up to. We've already found out from the last time we had him on, we thought the organization of mayors was 30. Now he's telling us 150. So stuff is happening clearly every day on his front. Really good stuff. So what I wanted to first ask you about, what are some of the latest developments around UBI and what's gaining traction on a larger level?
Yeah, so a universal basic income or a guaranteed income is an idea as old as this country. Like Thomas Paine literally talked about this in the late 1700s.
Wow.
In the Agrarian Revolution. I'm realizing that particularly the way markets work, without some guardrails, without a floor, it would just increasingly create the inequality that some purported the colonists were against and wanted to create a new country for. And then since then, folks on the left and the right have different means to get there, but have all understood that people need a floor. In fact, under President Richard Nixon, we were a couple votes away in the Senate from having a guaranteed income for families in this country from
Wow.
Republican Richard Nixon.
I
And
did
the
not know
only,
that.
yeah, the only, the first guaranteed income experiments in this country were led by Donald Rumsfeld under Richard Nixon in community as a response to the unrest of the 60s. So the
Wow.
idea is essentially that given that we live in a society, that we should create a floor for everyone. If we're not going to have any ceilings, then we at least need a floor that no one could fall beneath. So people have money for a rainy day. So people have just some sort of shock absorber or cushion or some sort of ability to have agency and make choices around sort of where they spend their time, where they work, et cetera. And it died after the momentum in the 60s because some very smart operatives came up with a narrative about the fact that in some of the studies, they found that marriage rates were declining. And they said, well, guaranteed income or money makes women and people more promiscuous. When the fact was, marriage rates were declining because it gave women more agency. That women had money now to flee abusive relationships. Women had money now, so they didn't have to marry the first suitor that came to be able to provide for themselves. So fast forward all these years later, in 2010, I remember taking a class at Stanford from Dr. Claiborne Carson, the nation's expert in Dr. King, who used to run the King Papers Project. And I remember reading Where Do We Go From Here in the passage Steve mentioned. And I literally underlined it as a freshman and said, wow, why have I never heard about this? And I was so shocked because, particularly as a black boy in church, every year for 10 years, I did Dr. King reenactments, Dr. King plays, Dr. King essays, Dr. King speech competitions. My senior high school thesis was on the differences between Dr. King and Malcolm X's ideology. So I thought I knew a little bit something, and I had never heard anyone grapple with that piece of his legacy. So I remember telling myself it'd be really cool to be a part of that conversation one day. And had no idea, 10 plus years later, I'll be in the conversation in a very deep way. So since then, in 2017, connected with a group called Economic Security Project and decided to launch a guaranteed income demonstration in Stockton, where we gave 125 people $500 a month, all philanthropically funded, had all type of backlash. People were upset. It was the most. People like Sarah Palin were tweeting at me and saying, can you believe this? People like Chuck Woolery. And the thing about what Sarah Palin was interesting is that in Alaska,
They
they have a
have that,
permanent
yeah.
fund, which is a form of guaranteed income where every year in Alaska, they give people money based off the oil reserves. Spend it any way you want. You don't have to earn it. You're just giving it. And in fact, some argue the reason she became a vice presidential nominee was because when she was governor, she increased the payment amount. And that's why her favorability ratings were so high, because she was giving her people
Yeah.
money. So long.
I remember when she came after you, and then your tweet, I think you like retweeted her program, and you were something like, is this you?
I said, I actually modeled it after the Alaskan Permanent Fund. Are you familiar with it? Those were the good old days of Twitter. It was still Twitter. So Charlene, I'll wrap it up. But longer story short, so we launched the first guaranteed income program led by a government official, an elected official in this country. And then a lot of mayors were looking and waiting. But this is 2019, so it was before 2020. But when 2020 hit and COVID and people couldn't work, since people were doing one-time cash transfers. So let's give a debit card to people to buy groceries during the pandemic, et cetera. And then when the George Floyd racial unrest happened, I saw an opportunity because in my mayor group chats and our mayor meetings, everyone was grappling with what to do to meet the magnitude of this moment, which was a moment like any other. You have this pandemic where everyone's wearing masks and at home, and you have every city in this country having some sort of protest against police brutality. And I think I pulled together a group of mayors who I thought were leaders across the country that people would respond to. And I said, well, look, you guys, when Dr. King talked about this crazy thing that y'all think I'm crazy for in Stockton called guaranteed income, you know, in that year, 1967, there were over 100 protests, civil unrest in cities. I said, Dr. King looked at that and saw that it wasn't just about police brutality. It was also about like the violence, structural violence, the violence of poverty. And I said, in this moment, we have to just be bold and say, we'll do what we can, but the federal government has to give our people money. So it was really the pandemic and George Floyd that created the opportunity. And we had 11 founding mayors join us. And now we're at 150 mayors. We're at almost 50 county officials who are not only saying, I support guaranteed income, but doing those projects in their city. So it started in Stockton with $1 million in philanthropic money and 125 people, has now impacted tens of thousands of people across the country and $250 million in public dollars as mayors and county officials use ARPA funds to create guaranteed income programs throughout the country.
Can you say a little bit about it? Really is. And I actually hadn't fully grasped that it came together during the pandemic, just with 11 folks. Can you just say a little bit about what are some examples of how the mayors are doing the work?
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think because they're pilots and not like the scale we want them at, every mayor is doing a different thing. And we also set up a research center, a Center for Guaranteed Income Research at UPenn, to evaluate the 50-plus mayor and county-led pilots under the Mayors for Guaranteed Income and Counties for Guaranteed Income umbrella. So, for example, in St. Paul, Mayor Melvin Carter was the first mayor to use public funds and got in a fight with his congressperson about whether to use ARPA funds, and had to work with Mayor Garcetti to talk to Treasury under Republican administration.
Can you just explain what ARPA is?
American Rescue Plan dollars. So every city and county received a bunch of money to deal with COVID. And Mayor Crowder was like, well, I could do let's use this ARPA dollars to give people money. Like, it's a COVID response. So he did that. And his Democratic congresswoman was like, that's not allowable. So he got a big spat with her. Him and Eric Garcetti had to meet with Treasury. And got to give credit where credit is due. Secretary Mnuchin and that Republican Treasury signed off and said we could use ARPA dollars to do guaranteed income products to give folks money. So to answer your question, in Long Beach, Congressman Robert Garcia, then Mayor Robert Garcia, did a guaranteed income program focused on the poorest single mothers in the poorest zip code in Long Beach and targeted it that way. In St. Paul, Minnesota, Mayor Carter did three different demonstrations, one focused on artists, one focused on refugees and people resettling into the country. Like, how bold is that? And one focus on mothers in poverty who are also part of their childhood savings accounts program. Mayor Poe and a group in Gainesville, did a guaranteed income program focused on folks returning from prison. Mayor Hancock in Denver, now an MGI fellow in a community group, the Denver Basic Income Project, did a basic income project focused on folks experiencing homelessness. For you, just gave them folks money.
I'm going to talk a little bit about California, right? And so just even to set the stage in the context, right? One of the things that's like very underappreciated by people who study politics is the whole Depression era political movement in California, led by Upton Sinclair, the author, who actually ran for governor on a platform calling for End Poverty in California, EPIC. And that he won the Democratic nomination and actually came fairly close to winning the gubernatorial election, and then elected a lot of people on his platform running for state legislature on this EPIC platform about ending poverty. So you've created an organization in California called EPIC. So can you tell us about what that is and what work you guys are doing?
Yeah, so after I lost re-election, spent some soul searching, and I tell people all the time, I think before that, it was very easy for me to answer like what I was like willing to win for, but I didn't yet have clarity on like what was I willing to lose for, like risk it for, like fight for. It became very clear to me, like for me, that answer was clearly poverty and ending white supremacy. Like I'll fight, argue, tweet, lose all day for those, particularly for those two issues. And I thought, well, I mean, the worst that could happened, at least politically. It was like, and I'm still here, so let's do something. With all these lessons and with all these learnings. So I spoke with the governor and told him I was interested in really being a bold voice on poverty, but I didn't necessarily want to be constrained by his political realities, right? Like I get it as a executive, you have to govern pragmatically. I'm free. Like, so I'll be an advisor. I'll give advice. And I would say to his credit, California became the first state to support I'm guaranteed income programs, and he put $35 million in to do a statewide guaranteed income program focused on foster youth and pregnant mothers. Mm-hmm. That's become a model for legislation across the country. I only asked for a little bit, like a far less amount. He put $1 billion in to start a childhood savings account program. Wow. In California, so every first grader is given some money for college, and then doubled down into the baby bonds program for $100 million so that every kid who's lost somebody due to COVID and foster youth are also given a nest egg and some wealth to begin their lives with. And a lot of that came because of EPIC. So EPIC, I realized that poverty in California is a tall task. And one person doing a lot of different things, still doing the guaranteed income work nationally, needed help. So the idea was, how can I build a team of just brilliant people, and their job every day when they wake up is, how do we end poverty in California? And that came to me because in so much of the organizing, so much of the talking and listening, a lot of people, like as the Dr. King quote you gave said so eloquently, a lot of people fight poverty, but through housing or through education it's like, yes, and that's great and important work. And I said, but we just gonna talk about poverty, 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 poverty tomorrow, poverty yesterday, et cetera. So that's what EPIC is. It's a threefold effort. One, focus on working with the governor and our friends in the state legislature to pass pro-opportunity, anti-poverty policies. Number two, we did and we are still doing a listening tour across the state to talk not just with elected officials and nonprofit leaders, but like directly impacted people, not people who used to be poor like I was like 20 years ago, which is cool. But people were poor in 2024, 2023. Like, what are you thinking? What are the solutions? What's happening? And then we're also doing some narrative work. So we're also thinking about, how do we change the story around poverty in California? So we've done op-eds. I think we did a before and after. We can't take total credit, but even the amount of times poverty has been mentioned in the LA Times, the SACB, and the Chronicle since we've started, in CalMatters, is astronomical. Like, newspapers now have poverty beats, and that wasn't happening before. It wasn't just because of us, but we definitely played a role. We have a blog series with CalMatters where we have directly impacted folks write their own stories that we edit, but it's not like me going and being an ethnographer and saying, I met this poor. No, like, I'll use your story when I'm talking to folks, but I need you to write your own. We produced a mini documentary called Poverty and Power that just chronicled what we've been learning. And then we also did like a writer's room tour with Marriage for Guaranteed Income, where we met with different writers groups and different producers and network presidents to just talk about the cultural power they have and how do they depict poverty in their shows. And I mean, a lot of that work is hard to measure, but I love The Best Man Holiday, the movie and the TV series. Mm-hmm. And they mentioned guaranteed income for like 3 minutes as part of the newscast, where one of the hosts is like, you know, in Stockton, it was actually wild. Because, you know, when you do these meetings, no one falls back and say we're using it. So to see that happen. Mm-hmm. And then in Abbott Elementary, the teacher was talking about Dr. King, and the crazy principal who says nothing right interrupted him and said, but wasn't Dr. King also a champion of guaranteed income?
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So that's some of the work of EPIC. And it's been interesting. And I'll shut up after this, but I think part of what I want to do EPIC in addition to MGI is that MGI, we're organizing in like Texas. We're organizing in Iowa. We're organized. We have mayors Mississippi. Like, we have mayors everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I get why their poverty rates are so high. I get it. In California, it's all blue. Mm-hmm. And we have worse poverty rates than many of these places I mentioned. So for me, it was like, let's beg the question, like, how is it that we're so progressive, so blue, yet the folks that make the essential workers can't afford to live and are fleeing in droves? How are we so blue and so progressive when we have so, like, people from out of state come here? I'm like, oh my gosh, all these people live in tents and no one bats an eye? Like, all, like, there's whole communities of tents, and not just in one city, but in every major city and some non-major ones. So it was really like begging the question, because I was very curious, like, who is the pro-poverty lobby? Like, I try to think as simply as possible. And my question was, well, because we have poverty in California, something must be maintaining it. And it's either ignorance or malice. Like, either folks don't know or folks know or don't care. But let's figure that out.
Michael, what is it that drives you to care so much about poverty?
I think it's, what was it, four, I don't know if fourfold's a word. I was going to say threefold, but I think it's more than that. It's like four or fivefold. I think number one, just personal experience, just sort of being born in poverty, seeing family struggle, seeing parents struggle, seeing community struggle, but then going to Stanford and just realizing these folks were no smarter than the people I grew up with. Like I say that all the time. Like, and I'm so privileged. I meet with, talk to very important people, and very few of them, I'm like, oh my gosh, you are out of worldly smart. Like, oh my, like, it's just like, okay, like, that was a good conversation, but I just had a good conversation with my Uber driver here. You know, like, so that always drives me, like, this, the opportunity matrix. I think number two, as a person of faith, as a spiritual person, I don't do everything in the book right, but I do try to get right the stuff that's in red, which they said Jesus said. And one of the things he said was, when I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was naked, did you clothe me? When I was in prison, did you visit me? Just very clear. It needs no theological interpretation, no metaphor. It's not even a parable. It's like very clear. And I'm a simple person. So like the very clear stuff, I'm like, okay, I got that. I could do that. And then I think number three, we just miss out on so much. I think of my experiences as a city council person in the poorest district in Stockton, or teaching brilliant students in Stockton, California, and just seeing just how much genius is going to waste. Like, brilliant kids, charismatic kids, smart kids, bright kids who, because of the grinding nature of poverty, were never able to self-actualize. I was telling someone the other day, I like think a lot of problems we face as a community, the answer, if someone in poverty had like a chance to like go to Stanford, that would have been solved, right? Like, I think like for like disease, I think for a lot of stuff, there's so much brilliance that we're just leaving on the table. And I just think as a self-interested person, I want my life and my kids' life to be as full as possible. And for that to happen, I need everyone to participate. We have big problems. Like I even think about me and some of my classmates. Like if I hadn't been given, and that's not to say effort doesn't matter, but effort alone isn't enough. And if I wasn't given such opportunities and caught so many lucky breaks, et cetera, would we be having this conversation about basic income in this country? Would we be talking about ending poverty in California in this? So it's like, that's too much to leave to chance. And it's also avoidable. And then lastly, I think that, my kids, like the more things become stratified, the more dangerous it is, not just for the bottom, but for the top. Like every revolution, every empire collapsing has happened because of increasing and ridiculous stratification. Like at some point, if people can't eat, if people can't provide for their kids, if people can't get real opportunity, you're not going to be able to build high enough gates. You're not going to be higher enough security. So for me, it's like almost a, it's about future sustainability. Like the way we're going, it's collapsing. It continues to collapse, and will collapse even greater if we don't figure out the fundamentals now.
Let me just interject also in terms of kind of a personal kind of reflection. You know, so you know, Michael and Anna and Susan and I, you know, been partners, co-conspirators, friends for over a decade now. And I was reflecting back on that recently. Actually, I was listening to this podcast, Larry Wilmore's podcast, Black on the Air, and he had one of the actresses from Abbott Elementary. Hmm. And this person said about Larry, because he helped to bring into being Issa Rae's show and helped launch her career. And this person said that, you know, what Larry does is champion other people's dreams. And that, so, you know, I've obviously been reflecting on what Susan and I did with the essence of the work that we did. And so there was an element of championing people's dreams. And I thought about those, not just in the abstract though, that we've gravitated towards champion people's dreams that we shared. And that it's been fascinating, like going through all of Susan's papers and looking at her own trajectory, and that global poverty was a core passion and concern of hers from college and high school days. And addressing and dealing with poverty was something that I've always been drawn to from my own being inspired by the Dr. King as a child. And so I think, I don't know, I just wanted to offer that I think that that's really kind of the deeper glue around the connection even of this, you know, relationship and partnership, but how we are all passionate about trying to carry on this work of addressing poverty.
And let me jump in real quick, Steve, because I was reminded the other day when I was just doing my thinking that I think, especially ever since I've lost re-election, you've been consistently one of the only people that have reminded me about, like, no, this is what you care about. Like, I'm like, yo, I'm about to do this. I think I'm gonna do this. You're like, all right, cool, but what about ending poverty? And I appreciate that because I think it's easy, particularly when you don't have an office, to think like, okay, well, I'm not supposed to do this. And I think you've always been consistent, like, in office or out of office, part of your work has to be this. And I don't think I've ever told you that, but like, you're like maybe the only person consistently that's been like, nah, there ain't no breaks. Like, you got to keep doing this work, and I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, we're all in a lineage, and we're all carrying on this, you know, work, right? I was telling somebody yesterday about the, you know, what's it, the, you know, I have lots of Jesse Jackson quotes because they're so formative to me. Right? But there's so much in politics about downplaying poverty and not dealing with it and trying to go for the middle class and not even use the words the poor. Somebody told me, somebody runs a think tank in D.C., said that when Obama was president, they were trying to, he was talking to Rahm Emanuel, and they were trying to move this policy piece, which would have helped poor people. And Rahm Emanuel said, I don't know, I was not there, but this is the story that was told me by somebody who runs a think tank in D.C. The way the story goes, that Rahm said, we shouldn't do that. Poor people don't vote. It doesn't really matter. And Obama said, no, we should do it. We just shouldn't talk about it. Right. But I think that reflects the level of which this dialogue takes place. But in terms of these formative experiences, in terms of my trying to do my part to continue to be supportive to you, Michael, I remember, you know, in the 1984 convention speech, because all the people saying the middle class and don't talk about poverty. So Jesse Jackson, from the national audience, the stage at the San Francisco convention in 1984, stands up and tells the whole country, my constituency is the disinherited, the desperate, the damned, and the despised. They are restless and seek relief. And so to build a political movement on addressing poverty and dispossessed people is something that's not done, but is really, I would still argue, is desperately needed. So we're running on time. So I just wanted to circle back. You had mentioned both, we're talking to the writers' rooms and storytelling and narrative and communicating. And we referenced very briefly up top this documentary. So can you share with us what this documentary is and how people can see it?
Yeah. So I, as you mentioned, I had spent the previous decade being a subject of other people's gaze story. So I thought, given everything that's happening in this country, that was important to tell a story. What was happening with guaranteed income just as a landmark. So when it does happen, people know it just didn't happen, that it wasn't inevitable, that there were real flesh and blood people who spent time and political capital to make it happen. But also just to show the breadth of the movement. Because I know with when I lost re-election, so many people were so afraid that that had died. And I was like, no, we have to capture. It's too many people now. You can't, the cat is out the bag. So it's called It's Basic, and it's chronicles St. Paul, Minnesota, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Los Angeles, California, and Newark, New Jersey. And chronicles the mayors and the residents there grappling with sort of COVID and how the $500 was and wasn't helpful, and how these folks are, I made sure it was racially diverse. So we have some white men. We have a white man who works in a steel mill, who is talking about how he knows that he's taking years off his life working in this profession, but he needs to work, and how he was so, like, didn't believe in the guaranteed income, didn't believe in government. But when he received it for him and his wife when they had their daughter, and he was like, oh my gosh, government can work and government can see me. And it shows his conversation with his friends who are talking about people who are taking money from the government. He said, like me? And powerful. Or another caregiver, a white man who was a professor at Harvard, who had a special needs child which caused his marriage to rupture, and he becomes a primary caretaker. So he can't work. And lucky for him, this guaranteed income program was in place, mm-hmm. which allowed him something to be able to take care for a special needs child. Or this amazing bus driver in St. Paul, Lucille, who takes $500 and is able to somehow pay for a down payment. Well, I guess housing prices in Minnesota are different than California. But it was able to save enough to put a down payment for a house. Who had a criminal record, who had her job, got this good job as a bus driver, but then was shut down because it's COVID. Kids weren't going to school, and so I think it's a young homeless woman in Los Angeles we follow, and I think it's just a powerful story of like everyday people and how we're so connected. A, everyone needs a little bit of help. B, of these courageous mayors, like Mayor Siddiqui in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who was the first mayor to make guaranteed income a policy. And now in Cambridge, Massachusetts, if you're a mother 200% above the poverty line and below, you're given $1,000 a month for 3 years. Who could have thought of that 5 years ago? So I had to make sure she got her love. And she's a Pakistani woman, a brilliant sister. Or Melvin Carter, the chair of Mayors for Guaranteed Income now, the mayor of St. Paul, and just his incredible leadership and dynamism. Or Ambassador Garcetti, then L.A. Mayor Garcetti, then co-chair of Biden's presidential campaign, Garcetti, who had the largest guaranteed income program in the country at that time, while like having to do stuff for the president. And Mayor Ross Baraka in Newark, a legacy of sort of the Black Panther and the civil rights movement, and his bold leadership and how he talked about it as this is like what the riots were about or the uprisings were about. Like, it's years later, but this is how we build our community. So anyway, we're doing a 50-city tour right now. We've been to like 20 cities with all the mayors who are doing guaranteed income programs. Oh, we were for California visitors. We did one in Oakland at Grand Lake Theater. It was so cool. They had the marquee that said Barbie. That says It's Basic featuring Michael Tubbs and Libby Shaw. Awesome. That was such a dope moment. And yeah, so we're looking for a distributor now. Hopefully. It's funny because I think the appetite for political documentaries aren't what it was in 2020. Hopefully we get a distributor soon. Or look for a screening. You go to itsbasicdoc.com, and it has a list of the cities we're probably going to go to.
Yeah, so on that note, how do people keep tabs on what you're up to? What are some best ways?
Yeah, I think it's funny, because I used to be like a big Twitter person. But
I remember.
The best way now is Instagram, at Michael D. Yep. Tubbs on Instagram. But Twitter, I refuse to call it X. The only X I know is Malcolm. But on Twitter, it's at Michael D. Tubbs as well, MichaelDTubbs. Now, I'm trying to learn Threads, but I just don't have time. I don't want to learn any new. I'm like the oldest young person.
Yeah, I was going to say, Michael, you got old on me. And
I'm not trying to learn no new baby technology. Like, what's wrong with Twitter? Like, what's this thread stuff? No.
All right. Well, Michael, we appreciate you making the time to join with us to share about this work. And appreciate who you are and what you do overall. So thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate you guys' leadership and support. Thank you.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. Please help us get the word out about this podcast by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts, sharing with your friends, tweeting at Democracy Color and at Steve P. Tweets, and finding us at Democracy in Color on Facebook or Instagram. You can also keep up with all things DEMCO by subscribing to our newsletter at democracyincolor.com. If you listen to our podcast on iTunes, please leave us a rating and a comment. It helps others to find our show. This podcast is a Democracy in Color production. Our producer is Olivia Parker. Fola Onifade is our staff writer and associate producer. Charlene Chang is our editor and co-host. Special thanks to April Elkier for Quality Check. Recorded virtually with the assistance of the podcast studio of San Francisco. Until next time, let's keep trying to end poverty by ending poverty and keep the faith.